Gary DePaul with Unlabel Leadership. Welcome to episode 123, Nigel Payne on Trust, Diversity, and the Pomodoro Technique. Here's a shout out to listeners from Corona, California, Colorado Springs, Colorado, Brandon, Florida, and Jefferson, Georgia. With that, let's get started. Nigel has worked in learning and leadership for more than 25 years. He's produced learning software and award-winning multimedia materials, and he consults with global organizations, both in the private and public sectors, to help them develop cultures and create more humane and developmental workplaces. He authored 3 books, is the co-host of Learning Now Television, and is the co-host of the podcast From Scratch. Nigel teaches doctoral students at UPenn, and I believe he's someone you would like to get to know. Part 1, Trust. In Season 1, several guests have brought up the concept of trust and ways to go about building it. In this story, Nigel shares a different take on trust. Here's Nigel to explain.
I'm going to tell you a story about an incident that happened probably about 10 or 15 years ago now. And I was running a leadership program for young people under 30. So it was interesting, outstanding young people under 30, helping them think about their life, their career, and leadership development. I was older than 30 then. I co-ran it with someone from Google called Sarah Carr. Sarah was also under 30. We tried to do something completely different each week. So it was a novel experience. Even though we were using the same platform, we changed everything around all the time. And one of the weeks was dedicated to the group. So we asked the group to plan and then deliver the session without any intervention from Sarah or me. I was getting very nervous about this session. I kept saying to Sarah, well, should we ask them to feedback, you know, the day before? Well, what about if we have a little meeting just to check that everything's all right? And as it got closer, I got more nervous. And Sarah said, Nigel, you've got to learn to trust people. They will do a great job. If we intervene, we're actually giving them the message we don't trust them. And that's a really bad message. Trust them. We did the session. It was fantastic. They had done a great job. And it taught me a big lesson then. Just because someone's younger or older or from a different country does not mean that you don't extend trust. In most cases, when you extend trust, trust is rewarded tenfold. And it was with this group. And in some ways, that one session was almost the making of the whole program. It just took us to a different dimension. So I'll always be grateful to Sarah for just patting me gently on the shoulder and saying, hey, calm down, stand back, just let it happen. And I've used that insight thousands of times ever since. So thank you, Sarah.
When you're saying trust, what you're talking about, if I can interpret, is predictive trust. You're giving trust that other people will be successful in doing the objective or achieving the performance. And that's what you're talking about, right?
Kind of. It's not based on I meet you for the first time and I immediately extend trust. Oh, yes, you do half my session. That's fine, Gary. It's when I know you and when I'm well aware and in control of the environment, it's extending trust at that point in the belief that people will excel beyond what I could reasonably have expected. And that's usually true. So it needs some work first. You know, I'm a great believer in smart trust, not to crazy trust or naive trust, where you throw everything at a group or an individual or an organization and it gets thrown straight back in your face and you're worse off than you were before. So I think there's some real difficult issues around trust. Where you've done your groundwork, extending trust is a very important step to deepening a relationship with a company, with an individual, with a group.
You can always set safeguards. And if they come to you, that's different. But if they're not coming to you, if they seem fine, then relinquish control and allow them to experiment and do things the way they want to do them. As an outcome, in this case, it was fantastic.
You're quite right. That's exactly it. Do not step in when no one's invited you. for no other reason than to satisfy your own curiosity, nervousness, or whatever. You've got to put yourself in their position. The minute you step in the room, you're giving a message which is not a good message. If you stay out of the room, you're actually giving a very positive message. You're fine. I trust that you're making progress. And I know that if there were issues, you'd come straight back. So yes, that's exactly right.
Part two, dangers of the echo chambers. There are several beliefs and things that you can do to help you become more effective at leadership and be more effective just as a professional. Nigel shares three things that can add to your leadership capabilities. Again, here's Nigel.
The first one is that the deep, profound lesson I learned, which is going to sound very naive, but it took me a while to learn it. And that is the realization that not everyone is like you. Not everyone is motivated like you. Not everyone reacts like you. And you know, as a developing leader, the idea of that recognition was, again, like a slam around the back of the head. Because I realized that showing compassion is sometimes the best way to build a relationship rather than trying to drive people or focus exclusively on objectives. So I've learned more and more that if you show compassion and you try to get inside people's shoes, they will respond much more positively than if you try to drive them, be intolerant, focus only on their objectives that you seem to be in control. Or imagine that it's about you in the sense that your success depends on them doing what you said, rather than looking at our success. And our success inevitably, in my experience, involves everybody growing, doing things that they didn't think they could do, moving forward in ways that they didn't think imaginable, or working as a team in a way that would have seemed impossible before. And what I've realized, if you can get growth from everybody involved, the end result is not just we get there, we do what we needed to do, but we do everything we needed to do and build for the next and the next and the next iteration. Whereas if we get there through conflict, pressure, lack of tolerance and understanding, you may get there, but you actually create a demerit, a negative force for the next time and the next time. And often you are, in doing that, in pushing people without understanding, you're ending up leaving them in a worse place and perhaps even getting them to feel that they are incapable of doing something that they're perfectly capable of doing. So it's a big lesson for me, and it's been a driving force in my entire career and also outside work. If you give people space to let them learn and grow in their own way and try to understand the pressures and forces on them. And in some ways, COVID and the pandemic has encouraged us to see that we're actually working with human beings, not workers. The difference between work and not work is when you control and you don't control. To see it actually as whole people who you need to understand as whole people and understand the pressures and the forces that interact with them. That has become more and more important to me. And I think it's more and more useful as an insight. I regret, in a way, that it took me a while to come to that. You know, I was very driven by, we have to get this done. We have to get this done without considering the full circumstances for everybody. And when I ran an organization, you know, there were huge deadlines and lots of pressure. I probably could have shown a little bit more compassion on some of those occasions when we were really under the cosh.
When you're showing compassion or empathy, it's such a positive thing because you're opening up the possibility of trying to understand intent. It breaks down the judgment and stereotype yes. that can happen and opens your mind to be able to learn from the other people.
And also the other way around too, Gary, that it breaks down the judgment on me as the leader, and people can jump to judgment and say, this guy is simply driven by results. He doesn't care about any of us. He would drop any of us in a heartbeat if it was in his interests. And I don't want to be seen as that kind of person. So, yes, it works two ways. You see a different kind of person in front of you, and they see a different kind of person in front of them. That mutual understanding is incredibly powerful. It builds links and connections. And, you know, my new obsession is with building connection in organizations. I'm focusing a lot of research on organizational learning. And organizational learning is all about connections. It's not about individual excellence or individual drive or individual success. It's about the linkages and the connections. So, yes, I'm a great believer in exactly that, Gary.
Yeah, so much more happens when we work together. The wisdom of the group, some writers have written about, is so much higher, elevated than the intelligence or wisdom of the individual.
You're quite right. And that kind of leads to a related insight, which is to learn from diversity.
Ah.
And if that doesn't happen normally, then seek out diversity and talk to the disruptor, talk to the person who would seem to disagree with you most violently. Try to understand their point of view and give everyone in the room equal time, equal mental cognitive processing time. Because we tend to maybe have everyone in the room, but we spend a lot of time focusing on those people who agree with us and very little time focusing on those people who disagree. And sometimes the insight from disagreement is greater than the insight from agreement. So I've spent a lot of time recently in the last maybe 20 years really thinking about how diverse is this room? Is it an echo chamber for my own views? Or have we genuinely gone out there and sought to try to understand more holistically? So not only do I believe in understanding people holistically, I believe in trying to understand situations holistically. In every one of those circumstances, we ended up making far, far better decisions. But I had to kind of almost take myself out of the equation in all of that. So not to see myself as I am the leader, they will do what I want. To say I am the learner, let me try to understand the perspective. So if you like, from teacher to learner, from leader to learner has been a really valuable transition. And I slip into that all the time, the learner mode. I learn from absolutely everybody and everything. It doesn't mean I'm incapable of taking any decisions anymore. It just means that they are more informed, more rounded, and more useful decisions, I think, ultimately, particularly in an era of unprecedented complexity. If you make the decision quickly, you end up making a decision based on only a small part of the equation. And when you do that, it's often wrong or dangerous even. So I think that thing is very, very important to learn from diversity and respect the fact that people come with completely different views of the world and they have their own sense of reality. And just because it's not my sense of reality doesn't mean it's any less valid than my sense of reality, unless it's based on misconceptions, in which case we can talk about those and argue those. But it's often just based on different perception of the world. There is no single correct perception, I would argue.
There's something that you said that I think is a good warning or something that people should really be aware of, and that is we tend to gravitate to like minds, to people with similar ideas. I just recently read a book called Lift, in which they were citing some research where they found that in the brain, when someone says something or you find something that is in agreement with your beliefs, your brain lights up. It's rewarding you for finding that. And when you find something that goes against what you believe, then there's no lighting up in the brain. It's actually a positive reinforcement to find confirmation and agreement to the way you think and view the world.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. That feels right, that we look so heavily and hard for endorsement, and it makes us feel good. In some way, it makes us feel human because we're joining with everyone who's like us. And that's where you get the dangers of having echo chambers. And you see in the US at the moment where everyone is in their own little private world where they exclude anything that doesn't agree with them. And their brains are lighting up every day. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't make the effort to move into challenge. One of my philosophies of leadership is that discomfort is good. Discomfort with psychological safety, but nevertheless discomfort, and to seek discomfort, to go talk to the people who say the uncomfortable things that you don't want to hear, listen to points of view that you find difficult and try to process that. And sometimes it reinforces your view. Sometimes it chips away at it and helps you towards a new understanding. It's like a kind of dialectical progression, thesis, antithesis, leading to synthesis. you can't have synthesis without antithesis. You've got to have something that disagrees with you. Otherwise, it's just synthesis. Ultimately, it goes nowhere. You just go around in a circle, literally catching your tail. I am truly a believer in learning from diversity. But you're right. There's everything in your brain screaming at you to find someone who is prepared to agree with you and endorse you and pat you on the back. And we walk down the road together, you know, metaphorically arm in arm. It's great. It's a good feeling. And I don't think you should deny that either. But I also think you should check out what is different. And I see in people, you know, I see in particularly in people at very senior roles, they've kind of checked out on anyone who doesn't think like them. You know, that you meet their team and they're all look to agree on everything and they're moving forward. And the CEO is telling me, you know, we are completely unified. It always worries me. And I ask them, where are you getting the challenge? If you can't get it in the team, you have to bring it in into the team. You have to look at the world in different ways. In some ways, that's an incredibly important part of leadership development, is learning to see the world in different ways. What frustrates me so much about some leadership development is it's almost intent on doing the opposite, making people comfortable, slipping in more and more of the same, telling them that they're great and doing a fantastic job, and almost shutting the door to contrary opinions. It's never a good thing. My third example is to learn to ask good questions, but linked to that, listen to the answers.
Ah.
I meet a lot of people who, when they ask me a question, they're not actually listening to my answer. They're formulating their next great statement or response. So they live in a kind of reflection zone where they say something which is fantastic. They then say something even more fantastic, and they don't even take into account anything that anyone is saying to them. And for senior people, it's often very, very difficult. And I do these sessions on active listening sessions with senior executives. And I always in the middle of it think, they're going to see me as a complete fraud. I'm just doing the most basic stuff. Ask a question, listen to the answer, reflect back the answer. And I'm always astonished at the end when people say, wow, I hadn't realized there is a difference between listening and active listening. And I think, yes, there is. It's so obvious. The fact that it's obvious doesn't mean it happens. So you know, I try to teach people to listen and ask good probing questions, not questions that give you the answer that you want. And I try to do that myself. You know, I do a lot of interviewing. I do a lot of, like you, Gary, I produce a TV program. I've interviewed hundreds of people. I'm getting better. I still see myself as a novice, but I'm getting better at getting in questions that probe, which are not asking for a pat answer, and that get beyond perhaps the narrative that the person I'm interviewing has come to me to deliver. That has meant I've done some really, I think, really great interviews, not all of them, but some great interviews where we've got beyond the obvious and we've gone in the sense of double loop learning. We've got to the underlying issues rather than the issue that's on the surface. I'm more and more passionate about the ability to listen and the ability to ask good, probing, open questions.
The challenge is that the average talker, and this is according to Jason Jennings, and I don't know what research he was citing, he said the average talker speaks at about 135 words a minute, but then the average listener comprehends at 400% faster than that. The logical thing that tends to happen, you nicely described it, is you start thinking of how you're going to contribute to the conversation versus what you suggest, which is inquire and listen and not focus on what you want to add.
Exactly. Exactly. And you can do that by trying to deepen the conversation. So that's a very interesting point. Just talk to me a little bit more about that. Why did you say that? And why did you use that example? Have you got any other examples? There are ways of extending a conversation so that you deepen the person's response, or there are ways of truncating it because you're just on the edge. I've got a point. I'm going to get in there. Sometimes that's useful, but most times it isn't, because you haven't really listened properly and you haven't really understood. But that's true. Yes, you're true. As soon as someone starts to speak, I get it. I'll formulate my own brilliant rejoinder now while that person is finishing. We miss the salient points or the deepening points or the profound points in favor of a kind of superficial grasp. That's always got to be wrong. And in leadership positions, it's got to be wrong all the time, I think.
I like the phrase deepening the conversation. You illustrated it so well. It could be as simple as asking for clarification or to explain a little bit more about a particular point. that may open up a huge window of opportunity or an incredible insight that you never would have considered.
It's all true. It's absolutely true. I can think of salient moments in my life where just going that extra mile, a really important penny drops, the insight occurs that would never have occurred if you'd simply rushed on to the next point. So I'm completely in agreement with you. And I think it's really, really important. This isn't just something that is nice to have, or if you've got time, or this should be fundamental to you to try to really understand what messages are going on in the room. And often that point you made about connection, that sometimes if you don't do that, you don't see the connections. You don't see the real knowledge in the room, which is not made up of one person's view, but two or three or four people. If you've just dismissed the first person, then you're going to inevitably dismiss the second, third and fourth. And therefore, that connection which joins them is entirely missed. And that could be the connection that saves your organization or gives you a great new idea or gets you a different kind of relationship with the customer, or whatever it might be.
Part 3, Threads of Interest and the Pomodoro Technique. In this story, Nigel shares with us something a coach once said to him about interests, the pursuit of or not pursuit of. And he also talks about a technique that helps him with his work. Here's Nigel.
This is a piece of advice that was given to me many years ago when I was a chief executive and I was working with a coach. We had a good few sessions and at one point he stopped me and he said, I'm going to tell you something, which I know coaches don't tell, but I'm going to tell you something. Nigel, everything is interesting, but not everything is important. That was a profound insight because I do find everything interesting. I'm naturally curious. I love exploring this and exploring that. The problem is, you know, when you're running an organization, if you follow every single possible line of inquiry, if you develop every single product that it's possible to develop, then you end up destroying the organization. And if you try to work as a leader without that focus of trying to settle on what is important, you deliver far less than you should deliver. I always still bring myself short, stop myself and say, right, okay, what is actually important here? What are the two or three things? I often do it to start my day. When I look at my day and think, how am I going to get through this? What is important? What do you have to get through? And if that means letting a few things that are interesting slide by, better to do that and focus on the important. I think that's a great insight for many, many people. Some people are naturally able to just focus only on the important. For them, I would say explore your curiosity from time to time. Just follow paths that you wouldn't normally follow. But for me, it's the opposite. It's, you know, I'll follow paths all day, but I need to be brought back to focus on what is important. If you want to achieve things, you have to focus on what is important. I don't know about you, Gary, but when I'm writing a book, I'll find anything and everything interesting because what I don't want to do is get back to finish that chapter or finish that summary or whatever I do or finish those notes. It's really good. When I'm writing, I use the Pomodoro technique so I get to that focus on what is important. And today, what is important is you're going to write 3,000 words or whatever I'm going to, what the target I've set myself. It really helps me just to talk myself into focus and not into how about this and I'll talk to this person. We can do that because you could do that your whole life and you'd never write that book. You'd never make that conclusion. You'd never run that organization. It's a big salient lesson for me.
Having that outline, even if it's just an outline, could be such a saving grace. You mentioned a technique. What is the technique again, and how would you describe it?
It's almost beyond simple. It's called the Pomodoro technique, and it's called Pomodoro, which is the Italian for tomato. In the old days, probably in the 60s, one of the great cooking timers that was in every kitchen in America and Europe was a tomato-shaped device that you twisted the top against the bottom, and it went tick, 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 so you could time your cooking. So the Pomodoro technique is to work in bursts of 25 minutes and give yourself a break. For example, I will set myself six Pomodoros. They're called Pomodoros. after each 25-minute break, some bell will go off. I've got a piece of software that does it. It will say, end of Pomodoro 1. Even if I just stand up, walk around the room, give myself a few minutes off, then I get back to the second Pomodoro. So, and then the third. And then after four Pomodoros, you get a bigger break, like half an hour break. And so you can do four Pomodoros in the morning, have a lunch break, four Pomodoros in the afternoon. Or maybe that's too many, because if you're focusing, you know, it tires you out. But I find that idea of taking regular breaks and of the focus. So when the bell rings to start working, I no longer get up to make another cup of coffee. I can wait easily 20 minutes or 25 minutes to make a cup of coffee, take a phone call, do something trivial, but I'll do it after the 25 minutes. Previously, you said, right, I must start work. Oh, I just make that cup of coffee. I just do that phone call. An hour has gone by and you haven't done a thing. Whereas in my way, I would have done two Pomodoros in 50 minutes and I would have had 10 minutes break. And that is a really productive hour for me. You can look it up. There are books on it and there are apps on it. It's as simple as I've just described. It's working in intense bursts and giving yourself time off between. I don't always, if I'm really in the flow, I'll ignore a Pomodoro and I'll just work straight through. But more often than not, I find a 25-minute burst is a good time to really focus and concentrate and get something done.
My thanks to Nigel Payne. If you'd like to learn more about Nigel, go to the show notes. If you have a question or comment, go to unlabelleadership.com and click the message icon and leave a voicemail for up to 1 minute. I'd like to thank those who donate to the show. Your contributions make a difference because this is an all-volunteer service. I'd like to thank you for listening. This is Gary DePaul. Until next time, lead on.